now more than ever, people need to go within and plug into that cellular memory, plug into divine source, detach as much as possible from the matrix. A lot of these people that have all these abilities, who have celestial star ancestry, they're operating not only throughout this cosmos, but in higher planes, and they're working against the Draco Empire. The photonic energy and the cosmic rays will activate our higher centers. And it's incumbent upon us to ride that frequency wave. Hello again, everybody. This is James Bartley, and you are listening to the Cosmic Switchboard Show. Today, my very special guest is Mary Joyce. Mary Joyce is the principal writer and editor for the very fine website SkyshipsOverCashiers.com. Mary has written a number of books, including Underground Military Bases Hidden in North Carolina Mountains, Cherokee Little People Were Real, Tangible Evidence of Jesus Left Behind for Us to Find. Mary Joyce has worked for two major metropolitan area newspapers as a writer, columnist, artist, and a Sunday magazine editor and feature editor. Mary Joyce's career includes working for a Fortune 100 company, coordinating art and printing for Talking Children's Books. Mary worked directly with many creative teams, including those at Marvel Comics, Golden Books, Mr. Rogers, Berenstain Bears, and Steven Spielberg's E.T. book staff. And some people would say Berenstain Bears, but that's a whole other story, of course. Mary Joyce also worked for the world's largest private printing company, an air pollution control agency for a major city, a community college, and she also did advertising for 8 successful political campaigns. Mary Joyce's books are available through Amazon, as well as www.citylightssnc.com. And we will have all of the links to Mary's books and her website on our Cosmic Switchboard website, as well as on our dedicated YouTube channel. So without any further ado, Mary Joyce, how are you?
I'm doing real well. Hope you are too.
Oh yes, it's going very well at this end. This is an interview I've been really looking forward to. A special thanks to my dear friend, Bette Dotson of North Carolina, for putting us together, Mary. For the benefit of our listeners, could you tell us a bit of how you wound up in North Carolina, in one of the true UFO hotspots in the world? And tell us a bit about yourself that I didn't already mention to our listeners.
Okay, I didn't know I was going to walk into a hotspot when I moved here in 1998. And it's proven to be exactly that. Not only do we have UFOs, we have little people, we have Bigfoot, we have underground facilities, and that's quite a bit to capture one's imagination. So I really just walked into it.
How long did it take before you started hearing reports, or before you even had your own ET sighting or UFO sighting?
The first thing that really started was before the website started, which was about the Cherokee Little People. And when I moved here, I had never heard of the Little People before. Kind of dismissed it as just kind of an old, you know, Cherokee legend of sorts. And one day, a man who's very well respected in this area came in to where I worked, and he said, no, they're real. And he said when he was a young man right after World War II, he was involved in the new construction of buildings on the campus of Western Carolina University, which is in this area. And every time they were cutting into what supposedly was virgin land, they would find these little tunnels, and they were always cut into this real dense red clay. They were square cut with a rounded top, which makes them more stable. And not only that, they found little skeletons. One professor kept a skull, which he thought was a child's skull, on his desk, almost like a decorative paperweight. And one day, one of the other teachers came in and picked it up and looked at it real closely and said, this is not a child's skull. It has all its wisdom teeth. So really, my interest started with the little people. And then after that, things began to happen with the UFOs.
Since the subject has been brought up, the little people stories have always fascinated me. Reading your articles, I was struck by the fact that the witness accounts sometimes describe the little people as wearing apparel that's reminiscent of what has been described as the wee folk, the small people in the Gaelic countries in Ireland and Scotland and places, wearing basically like little lederhosen pants and whatnot. Could you talk a bit about that?
Well, I can do two things. One, I first learned about what they call the Cherokee little people, which are said to look like the Cherokee people, only little. Since that book came out, I was contacted by a man in eastern Tennessee, and he has about 200 acres of land that has been in his family for at least 200 years. And he claimed that there were little people living on his land, and he sounded really credible on the phone, so I followed through on it, and two of us from the website went up to visit him and his land. He proved to be more credible than we had hoped for because he at one time was in top security for the State Department. So, and he showed me his military records and things like that. So he seemed to be quite legit. He said that the little people had been living on his land as long as his family has owned it. Those particular little people look more European and do indeed dress, he described, like lederhosen or leather pants, and he said they look quite European. So that's quite a different description than what I get from the Cherokee people.
The Cherokee people, they describe little people that look similar to them, only smaller.
Correct. The description of most of them is right around like 3.5 feet tall. And that's be consistent with both the ones that are Cherokee and the ones that are actually associated with the Uchi Indians. But the Uchi Indians have always looked very European. And according to one specialist in the Indian cultures in southeastern U.S., they originated originally from Ireland, and they had fled Ireland during a major flood, you know, many years ago. And perhaps they brought some of their Irish little people with them, which may explain the ones that are different that are in eastern Tennessee.
The gentleman you spoke to in Tennessee, he apparently developed some kind of relationship with the little people there, and they told him a bit about themselves, as well as their understanding of the ETs, or at least some ET groups. Could you elaborate on that?
Well, normally I try to keep articles on the website from getting too long, and I always try to have photos with them so they read more like a easy-to-read magazine. And we got so much information when we were with him that we broke it up into four different articles, and they're still listed under a section that you can find on the homepage. It's called ETs, Bigfoot, and Other Beings, and the four articles from the Tennessee story are in there. So that really supplements what I've done with the book, which is called Cherokee Little People Were Real. So together it makes quite a story.
Yes, he talked about the little people describing two general types of ET groups, one being the well-known Palladians, or at least a faction of the Palladians. The little people also referred to a group that they thought were somewhat malevolent. They referred to as the Dominators.
Yeah, the
do you want to comment on that?
Oh, yeah. They apparently are very, very afraid of the Dominators, and they say that they're very evil, and that they think of the Earth as like a ranch or a farm, and supposedly, according to them and some other sources, that the nasty ETs have teamed up with some within our government or our military, and they exchange the right to either abduct and test and people, or even to, it's creepy, but I talk about eating people, because it is the farm or the ranch, and it's a food supply for these really awful beings. And since the little people are little, and these Dominators seem to prefer children, they're extremely afraid of these particular type of ETs.
I can imagine, because they're, you know, in stature, they're somewhat childlike, so it's no wonder. And they also mentioned that these Dominators apparently were responsible for blowing up a very large planet in our solar system, which turned into the asteroid belt, what some people refer perhaps to Maldek.
I have knowledge on both sides of this issue. The more common belief is that the people that were living on Mars at a certain time self-destructed in a way that we might self-destruct here if we go crazy with our nuclear equipment. That's the more common belief, but according to these little people, the dominators were responsible for that. So where the truth lies, I really don't know.
And the little people also had a message for us humans regarding the dominators and what we need to do in order to ensure our survival.
Sometimes Xander, who's the man who owns the land, would have written interchanges with the little people. And at one time they wrote a note, and I can't quote it exactly now, but it was like, please help us. And it was because they were worried about the dominators. And somehow they thought that, you know, maybe Xander and his connections might be able to intervene somehow.
On your website, there's a picture of the message that was left. Some little had wrote, expel the evil ones,
right.
Which I thought was interesting. And I was also saddened by the fact, reading the articles, that so much of the habitat of the small people were messed up by drilling and mining and pollution from the surface people.
That's going to be a transition to another thing with the Bigfoot. They've run into that problem, too. We had a very extensive story. We've had multiple stories about Bigfoot, but we had one in particular. And the people lived in what I call a bowl-shaped little valley. And to get to the valley, it was a single-lane gravel road that followed a creek. And once you got to the end of it, it opened it up, and there were two houses and a barn and a little pond, or a pond. And the people that owned the land were having trouble with the pond, and somebody was out there with a jackhammer drilling into the rock to try to fix the problem, and suddenly the jackhammer went right through the rock into something that was hollow, and the water began to pour into whatever was beneath that. After that happened, the people on that land began to have trouble with the Bigfoot. They hadn't had any problem before that. And in hindsight, we all pretty much agree that they must have inadvertently drilled into a cave that they were living in and probably flooded their home, and the Bigfoot were not at all happy. That's another example of the habitat being ruined by humans on the surface.
Absolutely. The Sasquatch story has always fascinated me, and there seems to be a connection that Sasquatch has with some ET groups. Now, I'd like to talk a little bit more later about Sasquatch, but shifting gears to the ET situation over there, where I'm from, Southern California, Northern California, Arizona, there's a lot of stories about underground bases. Myself and my colleagues have investigated a number of them. Can you tell us a bit about what the people are reporting over there as far as suspected sites where there may be ET underground bases?
One of the books that I've done, which I didn't intend to do, I just kept getting more and more information, and I thought, oh, I need to put this together into one place. I've got a book, it's called Underground Bases Hidden in North Carolina Mountains, and it deals with the underground facilities that have been reported here in the mountains of western North Carolina. And interestingly, all of them are under tourist locations. There's one under the Smoky Mountain National Park, one under Mount Mitchell, which is the tallest mountain east of the Mississippi, one under Sugarloaf Mountain, which is adjacent to Chimney Rock State Park, another one in the Linville Gorge Falls area, and the fifth one is under the Balsam Ridge. It's commonly around here referred to as Parry, P-A-R-I, which stands for Pisgah Astronomical Research Institute. At one time, that facility was part of the Department of Defense. It did monitoring during the 1950s of, you know, satellites and things of that nature. Supposedly, it was closed down, and it is now said to be an astronomy research center. From everything we've been able to get from witnesses, it is a camouflage cover for a facility beneath it that's said to be six stories deep, city size, and self-sufficient. The first story we got about that was from a woman who had grown up in a family where her father was in top security work. And she literally, and her husband, would come into where I work periodically and kind of shyly start conversations with me about the website and about UFOs. And this went on for some time, and then they finally said, we'd like to tell you about some of our UFO sightings. And I met them at their camper trailer one day, and that wasn't the reason they really wanted to talk to me. They had been checking me out to see if I seemed trustworthy and credible, and they wanted to tell about this Perry facility. And she's the first one that told us it was, you know, six stories deep and city size and some of the things they were doing there. We posted that story on the website, and later we were contacted by a man with top security clearance who confirmed what she had said and said it was completely true. And so that's how it began. We had more testimonies after that, but that's how it started.
What seems to be the purpose of that particular facility, the Perry facility?
The stories that we hear that have a little bit of a dark tone to them of all five facilities that I've written about would be the Perry facility. One man that came forward later had worked on a tree farm, a Christmas tree farm near that facility years ago, and people who worked there talked about seeing animals being brought in cages into that facility, which makes no sense. Whether it's an astronomy facility or an old Department of Defense facility, why would you be taking animals in cages? The woman who first let me know about this said that they have a lot of abilities to do things that they can wipe out people's memories. She regarded it as a facility that could be dangerous to people. So there's things going on there that may be of the experimental version. Whenever I've gotten close to it, each time I've gone with other people, and we have all felt this, I don't know how to describe it. It's like almost an electrical interference with your brain, and it's like you don't want to be there. It like makes you want to leave. I refer to it as human bug repellent. So that's part of the story with the Perry facility.
We've heard similar things as far as the human bug repellent, these electromagnetic emissions that instill a state of high anxiety and panic and just the overwhelming urge to leave the vicinity. Also in places such as China Lake Naval Weapons Center, our sources there talk about a large, what amounts to a genetics lab where they bring in all kinds of animals from the surface, and they, you know, they have no restraint, no ethics, these people, so they create all these chimeras that probably shouldn't have existed in the first place. And another thing that's interesting is right above the China Lake Naval Weapons Center, there is a very large humane shelter for dogs and cats. And apparently, according to some of the sources, they take some of the dogs and cats from this humane shelter and they experiment upon them underneath. Now, in some of the underground bases, have you heard stories about any apparent collusion between humans, military, and non-human life forms?
Two of them in particular. One is the Sugarloaf Mountain facility. We interviewed a woman who lives at the nearly at the very top of this mountain. There's only, I think, six or no more than eight houses up there. And she told us about one night there were all these lights and there were these big aircrafts and or helicopters or ospreys or big equipment was dropped from these vehicles or from these airplanes of sorts and dropped on the top of the mountain. There were floodlights on the mountains all night long. And the next day, she and her husband made the 30-minute hike to the very top of the mountain, and they said the whole top of the mountain had been reshaped, and there was like fresh sod. She said it was like walking on a fresh grave. And so something had been dropped in there, and perhaps, I don't know. But to make the connection, she said they had also seen UFOs hovering above the same mountain. So that's one place where there seems to be a connection that we've heard from different witnesses. The other place is the Perry facility that I mentioned before. And there's a lake to the west of there, and people have seen UFOs fly in and out of that lake. So it might be a different kind of entrance into the facility.
What is often reported around these types of facilities is that there seems to be at times on the surface, a lot of mysterious military activity. black helos flying around, double rotor Chinooks flying around, military vehicle convoys that go into the mountains but don't seem to come out. Have you had similar reports in North Carolina?
Absolutely. We've had them at the Smoky, you know, the one that's beneath the Smoky Mountains. We've had reports like that there. We've seen a lot of the military unmarked helicopters flying from, you know, flying in this area. We've also seen all sorts of UFOs in this area. So we honestly can't always tell the difference between the man-made UFOs and the ones that aren't man-made, because I'm pretty darn convinced that we have both in this area.
Another thing that's been going on, too, and it seems accelerated in the recent past, Mary, going back a decade or so, is there seems to be even more underground tunnel development. People all over are hearing rumbling underneath the earth, machinery, the sounds of explosions beneath the surface. Is that going on over there in North Carolina as well?
It has. Maybe the tunnels are completed. I haven't heard reports of that nature real recently, but we have in the recent past. And it seems to us that these tunnels are being built between or constructed between these different facilities. Some of the witnesses that came forth had been with the Air Force in supervisory positions, and they told me that they were very convinced that there's a whole network that goes from, like, Washington, D.C., or Virginia, all the way down to Atlanta, along the spine of the Appalachians. And with the reports that we've gotten from people here, where they will, for a time, feel and hear grinding sounds and vibrations and different things coming from beneath the ground, and it only lasts for a certain amount of time. And as you probably know, the boring machines that they use underground can go at a rate of like as much as 7 miles in a day. So that would explain why they wouldn't be making a lot of noise for a long time. Some of the facilities may have equipment that's running that people can still hear. Now that's a different situation. We had a sheriff's deputy. He had to retire early from his job in Florida because of he had cancer, and he moved to North Carolina, and he loved to take his Corvette for rides up on the Blue Ridge Parkway, especially at night when you could see the stars. And he pulled over near a rock formation that's, let's see if I remember the name of it, it's Devil's Courthouse. And he had gone over to one of these rocks, and he felt something, and he put his ear against it, and he could feel and hear grinding sounds coming from beneath the ground, and there's nothing of that nature that's obvious in that area. But the Devil's Courthouse is right on what they call the big bend of the Blue Ridge Parkway in North Carolina.
Recently, you've discussed on your website the discovery, if you will, of a previously unknown underground base on the Tennessee-North Carolina border. Do you want to talk about that a bit?
Once you get something on the website, you get people contacting you, so the information continues to come in. This is still in this same basic area, and it just shows that it is a vaster network than what we once thought. I'm not hearing anything much different than what we've heard on the other places, and I've only written about it on the website. The book was done before that man contacted me. It's definitely there. It's near, right near, I think it's Tellico, Tennessee.
Another thing that I found interesting is, and this is something that we can confirm in our investigations in underground bases in Southern California, particularly in the high desert near the towns of Victorville and Barstow, that in some of the underground facilities there, people that were taken there unwillingly, I might add, we call them MyLabs, military abductees, some of the MyLabs that were taken into these facilities have reported seeing high-ranking Russian officers and other foreign military personnel, but they reported seeing particularly Russians. And I was interested to see that in the reports you've been receiving, a similar thing is being reported in North Carolina.
This is probably a good time to mention the World Heritage Treaty, which we as a country signed in 1972 under the Nixon administration, and it turned over certain pieces of property or land in our country to the United Nations. the idea was to protect certain sites. The Smoky Mountain National Park is one of those. And so even though these places are within our country, they are technically owned by the United Nations, and therefore different, we call them blue hats. The blue hats can be seen here in the backwoods doing maneuvers. And we've also seen Russian, not me, I've not seen them, but they've seen Russian and German troops here also.
Yes, we've had reports in California, in the Agora Hills, not too far from Los Angeles, of a UN base up in the mountains. And there are other places where there are large FEMA camps where there is related United Nations activity. And a lot of this really kicked into high gear during the Bill Clinton administration when he made that deal with all these former Warsaw Pact countries to have their troops train indefinitely, it seems, in the U.S.
But see, that again goes back to the U.N. owning the property. And a place where that became really obvious around here was the reports we got from Mount Mitchell. And again, Mount Mitchell is the tallest mountain east of the Mississippi. And the man who let us know about that, we call him Hawk. He was a medic in Vietnam, and then he went into a medical profession. And when he retired, he decided he still had a lot of energy. He volunteered his services to the National Guard here in North Carolina. And when they found out that he had had high security clearance with the FBI and the Army Intelligence, they decided to use him in a different way. And he was put in charge of, at one point, he was put in charge of a troop of men to surveil Mount Mitchell, and they did it very secretively. I mean, they had to go a long distance on foot, following animal trails and ditches and things like that. And they saw the backside of Mount Mitchell, and they saw the blue hats coming out of a building in the back, and they came out in groups of, or sets of two. There would be one man carrying one of those real heavy-duty backpacks, and there would be another man with him, and he would be the lead man. And they had four of these sets of two. And each was apparently assigned to one direction of the mountain, northeast, west, and south. So this man, Hawk, and his troops that he was in charge of divided up so they were able to follow each of these groups. And what would happen is the lead man would zigzag up and down the mountain, and they would stop every, I think they said, like 100 meters. And he would pull out one of these folding military shovels, dig a hole in the ground just off of an animal trail, and they would place a sensor device that was in the backpack and place it in the ground and cover it up. And he estimated that each team of two installed 50 of these sensors around Mount Mitchell. But these were all done by people dressed in UN or blue hat uniforms. Another thing that Hawk told us about was there was a camouflage door, a very large one that equipment could drive into, that was on the backside of Mount Mitchell. And he said he saw it when it was open, and then he saw it when it was shut. And he said when it was shut, you could not tell it was there because it blended in so well that it just looked like part of the mountain. Another thing that he told us was there was another group of our military in a town called Marion, which is southeast of Mount Mitchell. And at night they reported that there were 20 to 25 tanks unloaded from a train there and put on tractor trailers. And then those tractor trailers drove up the mountain, up Mount Mitchell. They never came back down, and they had this whole place surveilled. And there's only, I think, two roads, as I understand it, and those trucks never showed up again. So their conclusion was that they had driven into this underground facility, which is said to be 20 stories deep, and disappeared. He said the tanks were in what he called primer green, so they could be painted any color. That's something else that they reported with Mount Mitchell.
We've seen similar things in Southern California, not too far from the big marine logistics base at Barstow. A colleague and I were driving over a bridge, and we looked down onto these railroad tracks, and lo and behold, there was a really long flatbed, train down there. So we drove down there, and then we found about a mile long, like a flatbed of this train, was all these what appeared to be Eastern Bloc armored vehicles, circa like somewhat older looking, like in the 70s or the 80s or even earlier. They did not look like NATO or American vehicles. They looked distinctly foreign or like Eastern European to us. So, yeah, those kinds of things happen definitely in Southern California.
Well, one of the reasons that I've written about these underground facilities here in this part of the world is that anybody who gets into these kind of subjects is reasonably aware of the underground facilities in the West. And there's just not been much said about those here in the East. And if somebody else had covered the subject, I wouldn't have done the book. But I couldn't find anything written about it in any significant way. So I decided to take on the project myself.
Yeah, that's kind of how I got into this, because nobody was putting out, or it didn't seem that, at least in my neck of the woods, not many people were putting out the kind of information that myself and my colleagues are really interested in. So, you know, I was kind of dragged into it, kicking and screaming almost. There's a lot of ET activity that goes on over there. What types of ETs do the people there tend to encounter?
For the most part, we're seeing the UFOs more than we are having encounters with the aliens. We had one gal who lives up in Cashers, and Cashers is at the top of a mountain. It's really a place where a lot of people come when the weather's nice, and they all disappear to flatland when it gets cold. She, at one point, had somebody who was dressed in, I think it was a maroon-type jumpsuit that just appeared in her house, and I think that happened twice. We have not had reports of people having the abduction experiences around here. I'm not saying they haven't happened, but that doesn't seem to be a dominant thing reported in this area. We do, however, get some very, very unusual UFOs. The most unusual, I think you can find it under Skyship Photos on our website earlier this year. It looks almost like a rock or like a piece of an asteroid or a piece of volcanic, you know, material or something. I've not seen anything like it on the internet anywhere. It's the only time I've ever seen anything like that. So it's almost like a ship that's in camouflage. It's not lit up, but you could see it from the light on the ground, and it did not go zipping by. It hovered in the area for a while.
I'm looking at some of the photos now on your site, and some of these are, yeah, they're all quite remarkable, and I've seen similar craft that hide in clouds, and they even create their own cloud bank to hide in. As I saw in one of your photos here about a UFO creating seemingly a cloud cover. You know, we've been talking, and you've been talking about this apparent military underground connection with the ET phenomenon. Has there been reports of people, investigators such as yourself, who seem to have come under the scrutiny of these deep black elements of the military? People coming around, mysterious people asking questions or trying to intimidate people into silence? Has any of that been going on over there?
Personally, the only time I had an experience that was highly suspect was very early on at the beginning of the website when I still had my old computer. And for safety's sake, I would unplug the thing every night and replug it back in so a surge wouldn't knock it out. And I had worked on some letters one night, and the next morning I went to turn it on to find it, and all of my, I think I had about 10 files, not articles, but files on UFOs, all of those had disappeared. Everything else was there, which is very peculiar. And at the time, I knew a man who was responsible for maintaining and fixing the computers for the university, and he came over and looked at my computer and was befuddled by it. He said, "I've never seen anything like this. When everything disappears, when only one type of thing disappears and everything else remains." And he said even when he went in to the deep, dark crevices of the computer, he could find no trace of it. So that's the only odd thing that I have personally ever experienced. And since I, you know, have had two different computers since then, I've not had the problem.
Yes, it's unfortunate that we have to sometimes go through these kinds of things. It seems that someone or something isn't really pleased with our efforts at getting this information out.
Yeah, recently I was contacted by somebody who's had the negative experiences someplace else with the abductions and things of that nature. And she'd had her, I think, computers taken. So who knows?
Really? Like they came right in and they stole the computers?
Yeah. So
wow,
I don't, it could have been a regular crook on the street taking it and they didn't know what they were taking, but considering the background she had, you have to consider that there might have been more to it.
What's also connected, it seems, with the whole UN foreign military presence in America is the notion of protected terrorist training camps. And we've heard similar stories. After the first annihilation of Iraq, in their wisdom, they brought in a lot of former Iraqi military people, intelligence people, into Oklahoma, and then, you know, later on, you know, you had the whole Oklahoma City situation. There seems to be something similar in North Carolina. I think that your source, Hawk, had described it.
Yes.
That there seems to be what is described as an ISIS training camp there. Could you talk about that?
Yeah, I don't know if it's still there. Since it's gotten publicity, it may not be there. But Hawk, again, because of the background he'd had in the past, was part of the surveillance on that also. And there was a small ISIS cell northwest of Mount Mitchell. And he actually, it was rather like a movie. He was told to go to a certain place and drive down a certain road. And when he got to a certain motel, he was supposed to be on the lookout for somebody who would just raise his hand toward him. And that's how he made his connection. And then the two of them began to surveil the place where these five members of this ISIS cell lived. And the next morning, he and this other gentleman went to the church where the woman who was the head of the cell went to church on Sunday, which is rather unsettling when you think about somebody involved with ISIS going to church and came up, you know, blending in like a regular person. He described a fort that he said looked like a Daniel Boone fort, and he saw people of several different nationalities and the blue hats and people with, I guess at least one person with a swastika on, armband on. So either this was a legitimate ISIS training camp, or some people have speculated that the military may be actually going through training that's supposed to be very, very realistic, and it might have been set up by us. I don't know where the truth lies. At least Hawk thought that he that it was legit, that it was a real thing, and he was my first-hand source. The other sources have been two or three times removed from the reality of what's going on, so I don't know.
And apparently Hawk was approached and threatened as far as revealing what he saw. Is that the case?
That's the case. Actually, my book has it all, but I can't remember all of it myself, and that's terrible, isn't it? But anyhow, this guy had one of those special knives. He pulled it out when he was threatening him that he should not talk. And he said, "Do you know what this is?" And Hawk just said, "Well, it's a knife." But it was a special hook knife, and the man told him it was used for killing people. No longer lives in the area, by the way.
Yeah, well, he's seen enough and he's done enough. Thank you, Hawk, wherever you are, for taking the time out and risking your life to do all this, wherever you may be. Has there ever been any interest evinced by the local media about all the underground base activity and the military activity? They must have gotten reports over time.
I've been on local television about the Cherokee story. I have never been approached other than on the internet from the media regarding the underground facilities. I don't think the standard traditional media is even allowed to do things of that nature.
Yeah, I agree. If anything, they would do it in a kind of a debunking fashion to kind of bring up the subject and then make light out of it. You talked earlier at the outset of the show about Sasquatch. Could you tell us a bit about what the nature of the Bigfoot sightings there seems to be? There are reports of Sasquatch reaching out and making contact with certain people and developing an off-and-on relationship with certain individuals.
Well, let me go back to the story that I was telling you before. because it starts out bad and it gets better. The Bigfoot, like I said, seemed to be very upset that their underground home had been flooded, and they were getting all over the two homes on this land, and I went through both houses with the people, and you could see their fingerprints. There was a big clump of hair, and we have a picture of it on the website, I think about a year ago, and it's about 6 or 7 inches, and it's a big clump of hair, and they invaded the house to the point where the people moved out, but the people would still go back and check on their house. They went in, and in the children's room, it looked like little Bigfoot had been in there, like it became their little playground. And they had done, we have pictures of all this on the website, where they had done writing on the wall, scribbling, drawing, things of that nature, and it was all, for the most part, beneath the level of a light switch. And so it's hard to imagine that the real Bigfoot people would be down, hunkered down, trying to draw close to the floor with crayons or whatever. They were curious. You could see where they had played with the toothpaste. They had, I think, tried to figure out how a toilet worked. Thank God they didn't know, thank God they did not know what it was for, but you could see where they tore it up. And so the people eventually, I think, sold the house. I have got to find out what's happened to the people who bought it. That was the story. But no, the good part, I forgot the good part. The good part is that several of us went back out there at another time. And one of the gals is very telepathic. And she went down to the closest area where the Bigfoot would be. And she telepathically was trying to communicate that nobody meant to do what happened, et cetera, et cetera. And shortly after that, the woman who owned the house, when she came to check on it, she found a piece of, like, burlap that had been shaped into kind of like a basket. And there were different things that had been left in this little basket right at their front door, almost like a peace offering. The troubles really stopped after that. The man who had actually done the jackhammering lives in that area also, and one day he took me about a half mile off a gravel road to a place where he said there was a cave where the Bigfoot seemed to take shelter. And so he had a machete, and he would cut the path so we could get through there. And when we first started into the woods, we heard this sound of a bird, kind of. It didn't exactly sound like a bird, but kind of did. And then off in the distance, in the direction of where the cave is, we heard almost like an answer with the same kind of sound. And then everything went very, very silent. And so, again, we have a picture of that path. We have a picture of the cave. So that's another experience. There's been reports of Bigfoot crossing some of the gravel roads up here in the mountains, and we were fortunate enough, one lady had stopped by the side of the road to pick some ferns that she was going to transplant into her yard, and when she stopped the car and got out, she smelled that stinky smell that's associated with the Bigfoot, and she looked down, and right by the fern there was this large footprint, and there had been rain, so the soil was very moist. And we have pictures again on the website where you can see the footprints going up the mountain. There's an apple tree on one side of this gravel road, so it's like the Bigfoot traveled from the apple tree up the tree, past the ferns, and, you know, up and away. There's been several times we've gotten footprints. Last winter, we had somebody living close enough to this area who was able to go out on a regular basis and put food out for the Bigfoot. And we put it in an area where we saw the footprints. It became an experiment to see, you know, if they would take food. And then when they did, we started experimenting to see what kind of food they like. In that Bigfoot section, we even have it's like a quiz, and we have a picture of all the different kinds of foods that we put out for them so that people can guess which ones they like and which ones they don't. Like I said, we don't have somebody who can do that this year. It's not at all easy to get to these places, so doing it like every day or even every other day is not, you know, easily done.
Yes, considering how the Sasquatch like to hang out in really remote places that make it difficult for humans to get to at times. Have people reported Sasquatch closer to the more urban areas? Have there been any reports of them near the cities, for example?
Near the what?
Near urban areas where there's residences?
I haven't. The areas where we're seeing them, there are homes, but they're scattered.
And has the people over there talked about Sasquatch in relation to ETs? There's been a lot of reports over the years that there seems to be a connection between Sasquatch and UFOs.
These two people who lived on this land, one night they were out in an area where the Bigfoot often have been, and that particular night they saw, I think it was like five or six, what they described as giant owls. And these giant owls circled them. And the man had a very intense flashlight, and he flashed it on one of the owls. And he was shocked. He said the eyes were just solid black. They weren't like an owl's eyes. There's been much written about owls, UFOs, aliens, and Bigfoot all being a phenomena that's found together. So the owl adds another dimension to that.
Yes, there's an individual out there who wrote a book about the owl ET connection. I'd love to get him on the show.
Yeah, we reviewed it on the website. It's a book I never would have read if these people hadn't told me about this experience.
Yes, some people I know very closely have told me about an ET owl connection in their own personal experiences, where they would just be followed at times by owls and that seemed to have a connection in their mind with ETs. Well, we've reached the end of the first hour, and you've been listening to our guest, Mary Joyce, who's been telling us about a lot of the activity going on in North Carolina. Mary Joyce's excellent website is skyshipsovercashiers.com. Is there a way for listeners to contact you with reports, Mary?
On that page, on the home page, there's something called, at the very top it says how to report sightings, and it has my name, the website, my mailing address, and my email address, so I can be contacted that way.
You've been listening to the Cosmic Switchboard Show. If you like what we do, if you believe in what we do, please go to our website, thecosmicswitchboard.com, sign up and become a member. And we're just getting started, and we'll see you at the top of the next hour.